And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. It is a brand new year.
Yeah,
and we have two movies to talk about this week. Yes, Happy New Year, everybody. Lots of shit's been happening. I had a baby, you guys. Who knew that was going to happen?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I don't know. The new perspective you now have. You know what? On Miskatonic Musings, I'm already going on a tangent. I'm sorry. But
Just start off. We're starting off the year, man. Just start it off.
So on Miskatonic Musings, Lehman talks quite a bit about having a sometimes hypersensitive reaction to, like, child endangerment. Like, he is now father to two young kids, and he's, you know, he looks at horror content differently, especially when it relates to child endangerment. I'm curious if, do you feel anything shifting in your own viewing preferences or reactions?
Well, I mean, and then once we get into Bird Box, you know, there's certain theories of like, oh, what is this an allegory for? And one that I think you could probably say is like, okay, it is an allegory for becoming a parent, and people approach it different ways. But no, you know what? The part that bothered me the most more about A Quiet Place and Bird Box both is the labor scenes. That apparently is what's driving me crazy in films.
Okay.
Especially in Bird Box, it's very dramatic. There's a double birth scene, and it's just writhing around making noise. And I was like, I had a different experience.
Yeah.
You know?
So your family is kind of traditional, like almost a throwback to the Arrested Development, like children are meant to be seen, not heard.
Yes, but true.
Was your delivery similarly like, Mindy, do you need to be that loud?
You know, that giving birth is a horror show in many different ways. But what ended up happening? So I was woefully like unprepared for things that I just didn't understand how things worked. And I thought like you don't get the epidural until like the very end. Yeah. And so that's not true. You could get it like whenever the fuck you felt like it. And so I like kept it going for like 5 hours. And I was like, this really is bad, guys. Like, I feel really bad. Can we talk about this? Like, when can I get this epidural? And then a nurse came in and she was like, you can have that whenever you want. I was like, let's get on that stat. And then I was feeling no pain. And I think if everyone just got an epidural from the very beginning, people wouldn't be so like upset about labor.
Okay. What have movies taught me? That there is a point far enough along where they can't give you an epidural.
That's a true statement.
Okay. But otherwise, like me, like, I was in labor early and often.
Yeah, I was in labor for 24 hours. Like, I didn't even have to wait that early amount of time that I waited. I could have just gotten right on it.
Okay, this is a very silly question, I realized before I ask it, but you were delivering for 24 hours. You were awake that whole time?
No, like in the beat. So I had the water breaking situation. This is TMI, good for everyone. So that happened at 1 o'clock, and I was like, maybe I just peed my pants. And I went to bed. I went back to bed.
Oh my God.
Because I was like, this is probably not what that is, you know.
And sleep is so precious.
A lot of people, their water doesn't break. It's not like in the movies. So I was like, that's probably not going to happen to me. So I went back to bed, and then I like woke up at 9. And I was like, I think I should call the doctor. So then we went into the hospital and we're like, they'll turn us around. And then they were like, no, you're in labor. And I was like, okay.
Wait,
and
so
then I was there all day. And then
so
to the next
water breaking, it's not part and parcel with like contractions follow shortly behind?
It is, but they're like far between at the beginning, and they don't have the same like pain register. Like it doesn't hurt as much.
Oh.
Then you get like even further into it, and then it's the worst thing ever. It's like, you know those signs in the doctor's office that have the smiley face that's like increasingly like sadder?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know what a 10 is like.
Wow.
Yeah, that sad face, that was me.
And, all right, sorry, I've got other questions that like, I'm just physiologically curious. The pain you're describing, Is it the uterine contraction?
What's the pain? It's like a blinding, terrible pain.
But is it centralized, though? Is it whole body?
No, it's mostly like down your back and in your like uterus area.
Okay, so it's
in
like
your situation.
Uncontrollable groin spasm.
Yeah, a little higher than that, Darren. Yes, but yes.
Oh my God, I'm 10 years old. I'm sorry. That's rude.
No, it's really, really painful. Like, it's really terrible.
Yeah.
It's terrible. And I eventually was just like, listen. And then they get mad at you for moving around because you have all these monitors on you. And you're like, listen, I can't continue to sit on this bed, so I'm going to stand up and take a walk about. And then they get like mad at you.
Oh.
And you don't care about anything. After a while, you don't care about anything. Everyone comes in here. It's like everything's out. And all these people come wandering in and you don't give a fuck. And then when it comes time for the anesthesiologist people to come in, they're the best part of the whole thing. And you're like, you guys are the greatest. And they apparently an epidural is really disgusting to look at. That's what they shoot you in the back and everything.
Yeah.
But I don't recall that because I just recall like, okay, this hurts. I don't care. I would have agreed to anything.
Wait, so was it Jackson who let you know that like that was terrifying to watch you be injected by a long, thick needle into your spine?
Right. And then they set up this whole like patch thing that goes on your back to hold it all in.
Oh.
And then I had some complications and stuff. And so like partway through, I was like, my hips hurt really bad again. Like, and then I was like, why can I feel my hips? This is a terrible thing. And then we discovered like one of the tubes had come out for the epidural and was just like leaking on the floor. And I was getting any of that sweet, sweet medicine.
Yikes.
It sucked.
So the epidural, I had no idea. It's not just a shot. It's like another IV
pumping
into you.
Yeah.
Yikes. That's pretty shocking. That sounds terrifying.
Yes, and then after that, so I'm allergic to adhesive, like the medical adhesive. So afterwards, clear about a week later, when they'd taken all that tape off my back, I had like a chemical burn that was like raised up. It was really, it's just the gift that keeps on giving.
Oh, well, I mean, you've got a beautiful baby boy to show for it.
It's true. It's true.
Little Sid.
Yes, my little Sydney Lydon. People who will recognize those names and know where I got them from. And then that's like a fun little treat for you guys who recognize it. And for everyone else, it's just a fine name.
So that you've been home, but I guess nursing and sort of caring for a baby doesn't really mean that like you're home with all this time in the world to watch things. Like you're running around a lot, but have you seen anything of note that you're excited about?
No, I mean, I watched Bird Box just for the show.
Yeah.
But yeah, so time means nothing now. Time.
What does that mean?
Because it takes like 5 hours. Literally to watch Bird Box took me 4 hours.
Wow, that is a long time to stretch out that not very good movie.
I know, and it felt like 20 hours. No, I've been watching Schitt's Creek, actually, the TV show, the funny TV show. It's hilarious.
Yeah,
we've been watching.
Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara. I've watched a couple episodes of that. Yeah.
It's really funny. It's really good. But as far as horror, not so much.
Yeah, I've got to do a list of things I've watched in the last couple of days. And I guess that's actually kind of exciting news. The horror movie meetup group that I belong to in New York, it is the New York Horror Movie Meetup Group. You can find them on Meetup. I've been made an organizer.
Excellent.
So now it comes with the responsibility of planning at least 2 different meetups through the year. And come February 2nd, shortly after my birthday, I'll be hosting my first horror movie meetup.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, it's the theme is an evening with small monsters.
Oh, okay.
We're going to be doing the original made-for-TV, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, with
Get
Kim
excited.
Darby. It's one that I've never seen more than a couple of clips, but I do remember it coming up. Guillermo del Toro was a big fan going back to when it was first aired on television, and then he produced the remake. But it sounds like it is a much loved horror movie fan throwback to, like, you know, the Friday night movie and, you know, the sort of made for TV classics that, that, you know, are harder to come by once, you know, in this digital age, but, we'll be watching the Blu-ray of that and the, in my opinion, the modern classic Attack the Block.
Oh, I love Attack the Block.
Yeah, I'm excited to watch it again with the group because I it's so much fun. That movie is so good. The writing is great. The kid actors are brilliant. It's got a great cast, and it works through and through. It's kind of amazing. It feels epic in terms of what's on screen and what they've made, but it's a relatively, like, low budget movie from a really talented director, and I'm really excited to share it with the horror movie meetup group.
Awesome. Two great films. You'll have so much fun.
Yeah. And in between, we are doing a DVD giveaway and exchange, where a recurring theme with the horror movie meetup group is that, you know, people get, like, the, you know, the newest metal box version of, you know, the Blu-ray disc for this movie. And people wind up with, like, doubles and triples of their favorite movies. And every once in a while, people, like, bring in stuff to sort of distribute amongst the group. And I was like, there's something there. I think all of us have a bunch of discs we'd be happy to trade or give away and just see that they go home to another happy home with another horror fan. So we're going to be doing that. So I'm going to be bringing in, I've got a stack in front of me. We're all going to be bringing in stuff and trading it around. So if you're in the New York area, or I would venture to say if you're in the New Jersey area even, and you're listening to this, you might make it into the city for a February 2nd. That is a Saturday night at the Stone Creek Tavern. We'll be in the back room watching movies and exchanging DVDs.
And where can they find other information about your group?
They can find us on meetup.com if you do a search for NY Horror Meetup Group.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. But all right, now on to actual business. Let's talk movies.
All right, so we have two that will tickle the senses this week. I don't know, I've been feeling like very like Elvira. I don't know, I feel like I want to change my persona on this show and be like, give quips, like that would be my new role.
You got to start writing puns. Yeah,
I know.
What's going on?
People describe seeing an entity that takes on the form of your worst fears.
Oh my God!
What are you looking at? What did you see? What is wrong with you? Please stop it!
We can't stay here.
Every contact we have had with the outside has brought us death.
Your kids, they deserve hope.
Every single decision I have made has been for them.
Going on the trip now, it's going to be rough.
Hold on!
If you hear something in the woods, you tell me. If you hear something in the water, you tell me. But under no circumstance are you allowed to take off your blindfold.
Did you hear that?
So we're going to be starting out with 2018's Bird Box, a Netflix original film directed by Suzanne Bier. Okay. Screenplay written by Eric Heiserer, but it's based on the novel by Josh Mallerman.
Yeah, and the novel is from 2014. So I had first heard about this because my mother, I think, listened to the audiobook for it and was very excited at the premise and the execution and recommended it to me. I didn't read it, but she liked it so much that she eventually heard that A Quiet Place was coming out and that the description sounded a lot like Bird Box. And as like a fan of the book, she was like, oh, I feel terrible that people are going to think that the movie A Quiet Place happened before Bird Box gets made as a feature film, and they'll think it's a ripoff of A Quiet right. Place. And that is kind of what happened. A lot of the public was like, what's this? We've already seen this done better.
Okay. I did not like this movie. There's certain things, though, I will say that I was still thinking about it the day after, and I was thinking about what is this film about? What would the book have been about, really? Because I think when a film is not good, people go searching for allegory where sometimes there's not, but it makes you feel better for why maybe it wasn't so good. So my allegory thinking is that it's about jumping into parenthood. I don't think it's about white privilege, which some people were saying that's what it was about. I don't think that's the case. And then I think we'll give an announcement for spoilers towards the end, but I have some thoughts on that too.
Okay. Yeah, no, the allegory in this case, like Sandra Bullock is a reluctant mother to begin with.
Yes.
And so to make her a reluctant mother of two kind of, I don't know, pushes the story in a way that I don't know necessarily makes it more dramatic, but okay. So I'm looking at a synopsis that tells us 5 years after an ominous, unseen presence drives most of society to suicide, a mother and her two children make a desperate bid to reach safety.
Right. Now, it starts out very much like The Happening.
Yeah.
People are just killing themselves. And it seems very happening. The acting is stilted and terrible, very much like The Happening. Sarah Paulson shows up. You think she's going to save this film? No, she lasts less than 5 minutes. I'm just going to tell everyone that right now.
Yeah, we've also got Trevante Rhodes, who I saw most recently in The Predator, and he was in Moonlight before that. He's very good. There is kind of a relationship pushed between him and Sandra Bullock that doesn't really work out, but anyway, we've got cameos from B.D. Wong, who the man is Dorian Gray. There is a portrait of B.D. Wong in someone's attic that looks horrible.
I literally wrote down, he's 59 years old in this movie.
No shit.
Yeah. How is, it's just not fair. He's never aged a day.
He's hogging the agelessness.
Now, someone who's also the opposite then, who is the portrait of Dorian Gray, is my dear love, which is John Malkovich, looking terrible in this film, acting also terribly.
You thought so? I don't know. With John Malkovich, it's a little difficult sometimes to sort of make a distinction between like what he's like and what his character is like.
I do love me some John Malkovich, but
I need him to be doing like a Russian accent to really make a distinction.
You must be kicking yourself for not walking out when you could. Be a judgment. But don't you worry, son. It will all be over soon.
We've also got Lil Rel Howery, who's the comedian. He's Raj from Get Out, and I guess he's got his own sitcom now. And also Machine Gun Kelly, who I had to look up because...
Is he a rapper?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and like musician, I don't know. Recently he's had some beefs with Eminem, but I saw that like, oh, there's a conspicuous person. And then in the cast, it was like Machine Gun Kelly. And I was like, I don't have a frame of reference for him, but there he is. I guess he also acts.
Yeah. And then we have Jackie Weaver playing the kooky old lady. But I do love to see Jackie Weaver in things.
Yeah. Yeah. Good character actress. She's the what? She's George Costanza's mother-in-law.
Yeah.
In Seinfeld.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so A Quiet Place, let's see, the comparisons, you mentioned M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening.
Yeah.
That came out in 2008. According to the internet, just in broad, vague understandings, the rough draft of Bird Box was finished prior to the release of The Happening. And so the idea of like an auto-suicide phenomenon, I mean, we talked about The Happening in our episode 150, and mm-hmm. I remember specifically talking about how the suicide moments are the best moments in the movie. And that's a dark thing to say, but just in terms of like your horror factor, your wow factor is most effective when Mark Wahlberg isn't on camera. And in fact, it is just these kind of montage moments where people are taking themselves out in really creepy ways. We kind of talked about like that should have been the movie. It should have been more that, less Mark Wahlberg.
Exactly. And then there's a little bit of elements of the crazies kind of going on there. So I said it was like The Happening and The Crazies, but shittier than The Happening.
Oh, really? That bad? You thought worse than The Happening?
I think the acting is really not good in this film. And even John Malkovich and B.D. Wong cannot save it.
Yeah, it kind of becomes a bottle story pretty early. And as much as, you know what? I like bottle stories when it's on like Mad Men, when it's on like Community and they're sort of calling attention to like the mechanics of a bottle story, when it's a crowd of strangers, or not necessarily strangers, but everybody's sort of trapped in one location. And, you know, it's a lot of discovery. It's a lot of characters involvement. A movie that does it extraordinarily well, but also pushes the horror component is The Mist.
Yes.
And that works way better. In this case, it is like seven people about trapped in a LA home, kind of watching the world fall apart around them. But like,
but this
I don't
has
know,
a
none
feel
of the characters are great.
To me, this really had a feel of one of those sci-fi channel films where they're like, let's meet all the characters really quick, you know, and they always meet them in a diner or something. And this is just some fancy house that everyone's in.
Yeah. And between Sandra Bullock, who this movie is really like bending over backwards to make look great. between Sandra Bullock, John Malkovich, Machine Gun Kelly, Lil Rel Howery, like it started to feel like when you hear the descriptions of like Netflix making or producing movies based on like algorithmic preferences, when people choose a pattern, like supposedly House of Cards was kind of an assembly of like, hey, people watch the movie Seven to death. They seem to really enjoy the movies of David Fincher. They also seem to love Kevin Spacey, at least back then they did.
Yes.
So throwing these people together into a project, this movie starts to feel like that. It's kind of like a, you know, a camel is a horse made by committee. It kind of felt like that.
Right. And then what you have is, so we'll be introduced to all these characters. We're introduced to Sandra Bullock, who doesn't want to be a parent, her sister, Sarah Paulson, who's like this Pollyanna, everything's great and awesome kind of thing. John Malkovich, he's an angry alcoholic that reminds Sandra Bullock of her dad, who's the Trevante Rhodes. He's an army veteran who's just a nice guy.
Yeah.
Every single person had this archetype that they had to be with, which it was just kind of cheap, I thought, and like not well thought out. You know, Machine Gun Kelly is like shifty. You know, the muscle girl, she seems to have some training. I think she's another army person, but you don't really know. She just says, I have training for this. And then the other pregnant lady represents like a responsible pregnant lady.
Yeah.
That's like her rep, like she's like the motherly kind.
Okay. She was that actress I recognized from a trailer for the Netflix movie Pumpkin. So Netflix also does this where like they kind of synergistically assemble people in projects. I'm trying to think the last time I noticed that. But just in terms of like having, oh, you know what? That's what it was. It was like different comedians appearing on Netflix shows. And it's just kind of like, oh, I keep seeing that person. Oh, it was also a cooking show where they had the Latin actress from Altered Carbon on a cooking show representing Mexico. And it just, again, felt like Netflix has a finite Rolodex that they just kind of go through the names and find, like, who are we already working with?
Yeah. I recognized her from American Horror Story.
Is she in that? I don't remember her.
She was in Roanoke.
Okay.
Yeah, she was in Roanoke, but that's the only place I recognized her from. And she's like representing, you know, someone who's got their like loves kids and is a good mother kind of idea.
Yeah.
And then I feel like then they didn't even have anything for B.D. Wong, so he just became gay architect. And they were that's good.
That stereotype. Yeah, so all these people are trapped in a house, at least when it's like Dawn of the Dead or even the remake of Dawn of the Dead. They've got a mall as an environment to play in. Here, it's just a fucking boring house.
Yes.
And so, like, the young couple goes off and, you know, fuck in the laundry room, and everybody else is just kind of walking around miserable and fighting with each other. Yeah, I don't know. So the problem... It's funny. That's how I'm referring to it, but it's also how the book and the movie refers to the phenomenon is the problem. And Sandra Bullock refers to them as creatures once or twice. But the idea that this invisible being can only affect you through the visual spectrum?
Except for it whispers shit in your ear.
Yeah, I had a problem with that. That this creature... In Sandra Bullock's case, it does seem to like take on the voices of people, and it's saying like relevant things to her. So like if you were to extrapolate from that, like it's also got some dynamic where it can read your thoughts.
Yes, because it knows people who are around you or whatever that you want to see.
Yeah. And so that seems like a whole, maybe it's explored more in the book, but it seems like, well, that's also terrifying and maybe useful for this plot, but it's never addressed.
I kept thinking as I was watching this film, like, I would really enjoy this as a book, but I hate this as a film. And then also, yeah, she calls it the creature, like creatures.
Yeah.
We only ever see like some leaves kind of come up and some whispering. Yeah. Which makes me think like maybe there never really is a monster and it's just part of this allegory thing. Maybe, I don't know. But like, how does she know it's a creature? You don't, it could just be a ghosty thing. Like, why do you think creature? It was just very weird.
Please don't take my children!
The creatures with the floating leaves and it just... For all the star power in this movie, like, you know, they paid top billing for people like John Malkovich.
Mr. Son of a Beach.
And Sandy Bullock. Also, just as an aside, the number of close-ups got really conspicuous and frustrating to watch. Like, there are moments where Sandra Bullock is in the forefront and there's some stuff going on in the background between the characters, but the number of close-ups was just kind of like, hey, Sandy, thanks for being in our movie. We'll put you in the forefront a lot.
And I was thinking like, yeah, please stop doing those close-ups because I have the feeling some work has been done that I don't want to see up close. And I feel sad about that.
Yeah. In the HD generation, close-ups, it's a gamble. It's a real gamble. You can't really put someone and have them fill up a whole screen. Some people's screens are pretty big.
Yeah, I was like, I don't want to keep seeing this. Like, you don't need to do this. We don't need to do this. Yeah. Especially because they would zoom out sometimes when she was doing these walks through the woods. Yeah. And you would see these beautiful, vast, huge scenes, and she would look so small. And I was like, do more of that. And then juxtapose it just with like her face on the screen. And I was like, why are we doing this? Stop.
Yeah. So however much money Sandra Bullock cost, however much money John Malkovich and the rest of the crew, like they could have transitioned some of that movie. I wouldn't mind seeing a couple more nameless actors who were good.
Right.
And seeing something more visually interesting done about the creature, because we do get floating leaves. And not even in The Happening, we see the breeze. That's kind of our visual note, right, of like the trees are activated and they are putting whatever creepy toxin in the air. Here we get leaves that start on the ground and then float into the air. So this creature... I don't know, causes a field of anti-gravity. This is a weird...
That's the thing, is like, why are we calling it a creature? It seems like some sort of, like, entity. I don't know, like not a creature. Yeah.
Or even actually maybe the book explores this more interestingly, but like the zombie making fungus that can like take over bullet ants or wasps.
Mm-hmm.
That would make more sense because if it's inside your head, then it can cause auditory hallucinations. It can cause you to see things that aren't really there. That would have made more sense. If it was a fungal-based contagion, it would have been more interesting than the, like, nothing on screen chasing Sandra Bullock through the woods.
I think you never see it because I think it's not real. It's just her own, like, what should I say? I think it was her own feelings, and that's what it represented. And
she's running away from her feelings.
Exactly. And it kills off all the other characters because those characters, as she's like working through that aspect of her, making that part of her own like self. So then she becomes a little more nice when that part of the character is killed off. And so I think she like takes on their powers as those parts disappear. So I think there's never like a monster. I think like, oh, she really comes to peace with her alcoholic father, and that's the John Malkovich part. And so then once she's come to grips with that, then John Malkovich is out of the story. And
she
then
learns to love again.
Yeah. And then there's like the crazy people are kind of like those wild card feelings that sneak up on you. I don't know. Maybe I think I'm thinking too much into this.
No, I think that works. I think both of our ideas kind of work with the concept. If it was a fungal infection along the lines of the, like, you know, the zombie making fungus, the few people who aren't immune but do act as like harbingers of the creature, it would make sense that they're like trying to continue the spread of this thing. And so they're working on behalf of it. And they talk about how beautiful it is, the sights they're seeing.
Right. And those are like, you know, those thoughts that everyone has that like lead you astray or lead you to do things you shouldn't be doing. It's like that part of your psyche. Oh, how about this? Let's just talk about this. The movie's called Bird Box. There literally is a box of birds. I was like, oh, that's that bird box everyone's talking about. Neat. There's a moment where the birds fall into the water. It's very cold water, and yet they're okay. And then they live their bird life going forward. I don't think birds can take that type of a beating and keep on going. I think they're far more fragile.
Yeah, I mean, that is their reputation, at least canaries. When they're in the box, I don't know. I don't have a lot of experience with birds, but I have a hard time imagining that once you put those birds in a box, and it's not as if, like, you put that box then on a shelf. They are being carted around the woods. I
also
imagine
by a little girl who's 5 years old, and little kids shake things all the time. They're not like nice and gentle with things.
Yeah, I don't know how good a monster alarm these birds are inside a box and how reliable. Like, I have to imagine there's a lot of like false negatives or false positives, rather.
Because I think birds like lose their shit over anything sometimes. If you honk a car horn, they start going crazy.
Right. I mean, you're finding out that babies don't speak English and that way only communicate through crying mostly.
It's true. It's true. But there's only, in babies, there's only like three options it can be. They have very low needs. They're not like, oh gosh, I can't pay rent this month. What do I do? That's not part of a baby's like problems. There was also, okay, so BD Wong owns this fancy, fancy house. And he's got this fancy car. But he lived in this fancy house with his husband. And they only have one car and they live in LA? I don't think so.
There's a number of issues in terms of like they look at the creature from a closed circuit monitor. So that throws out the idea that it could be a fungal infection because it can spread by any means visually.
Yes. And then why can't the creature come inside?
That's a good question because even when they do break through the window, because that happens inside. Yeah, I don't know.
Like, I didn't understand why when they go into a house, when they're like scavenging and the windows are all covered, they're like, okay, this is clear. Like, what a creature could be sitting in the chair.
Yeah. It's like, and they don't come into physical contact with it. That's never really seen or demonstrated, right?
No, they're not, I mean, like bumped out of the way. Jurassic Park chase that one time.
Yeah.
And so it obviously is more than just wind and leaves because it's moving the trees.
Right.
There's a lot of problems.
The special effect of the leaves hovering, I'm thinking back to that and how much that annoyed me because it just, it was such a bad visual representation of this thing that it's only, it's only worse than watching Sandra Bullock run away from nothing.
Then, okay, so let's fast forward to the ending, okay? So if you haven't seen this, skip ahead for the next 3 minutes, let's say. That's all it'll take us to talk about this. Sandra Bullock meets a guy, Rick, on the walkie-talkie. Did you think that was Rick Grimes? Because I kind of did. And I got really excited.
No, I got visions of like, 28 Days Later or I Am Legend.
Mm.
The idea of like, you know, there might be a false promise at the end of this
yeah,
radio,
I was thinking kind of like The Road.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is probably, they're going to eat you. and so then this is the big spoiler. I think they died on the rapids, and I don't think any of that ending was real.
I think there's a bunch of things that that weren't executed well, and so we kind of fill in the blanks with better ideas. I think one of them was that it was supposed to end a little differently. I think in the book, the people at the sanctuary have stabbed out their own eyes.
Mm.
They have blinded themselves.
Oh, I like that. That's dark.
Yeah, that's a little bit of like, you know, you don't fire me. Fuck you. I quit. That's
mm-hmm. I like that.
And as it relates to the monster, they did try a visual effects test and even filmed some with Sandra Bullock running away. And so there was like it was surprisingly anthropomorphic in terms of what the creature was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But when they did film it, it looked silly and it made people laugh. And they're like, as bad as this movie is, we're not trying to make people laugh.
I don't mind not seeing it, but I then also stop with the leaves. I don't mind not seeing a creature. That's fine. I can handle that. People can handle that. But don't like give me this leaf thing and then say creature, but it's really like the wind. Is it the trees? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel a little bad that like they didn't quite crack the visuals for this one. I don't have any familiarity with Suzanne Bier's.
Me neither.
Her work before this. She's a Danish filmmaker.
They were all movies I've never seen before.
You know, I read the script before I read the book. So I'm a little bit tainted, and I was always, for me, that was always kind of the starting point. So I read the book actually way into the process. And so I'm the wrong one to ask about how that process comes along, because I was already there. And when I got involved, Sandra Bullock was involved in the project. And that was part of the reason for me to want to do it, because I thought, this is a portrayal of a very... this is a very unusual portrayal of motherhood. And it's a kind of a reluctant mother, in a way. And for us to embrace that person, it needs to be Sandra Bullock, because she's not at all time pleasant. She's not at all time kind. She's pretty brutal. She doesn't give the kids names. They're called boy and girls. And I think for us to understand it and kind of recognize she does it for the right reason, I think only Sandra Bullock could do that. So I don't have that process. For me, that was part of the premise, and I can't see it any other way.
People did like The Night Manager, though. I'm not going to lie. People have told me many times about The Night Manager.
Okay. Is that, how far back is that movie from her?
It was a mini series. It was the TV mini series on the BBC.
Oh, okay.
And that Tom Hollander is in it, who he plays one of the crazies in this film. And he's also in Taboo, if you watch Taboo.
Still haven't gotten around to that.
It's really good. But he was in it and he's in this as well. But people have told me, oh, this is really good. It's a Tom Hiddleston kind of jump off Hugh Laurie TV show.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I get by the sounds of it, she has done better work than this. So good for her. Yeah, I don't know. I feel bad. Netflix was pushing this movie really hard, but there wasn't a lot to like. I mean, even as much as I like Sandra Bullock, like part of her character is that she's meant to be severe. She's reacting to very right. extreme situations, but I never came around to actually liking her character.
Oh, you never do. I don't think you ever, anyone ever does. You just go, well, this is shitty.
It's a weird basis for a protagonist in a movie, especially something that's like, you know, again, even thinking of this as horror, not really. I think like those suicide moments.
Well, see, so I watched this with, because my mom is, you know, helping with the new addition to our family and everything. So my mom is here and my mom doesn't really love horror movies that much, the like gory ones. And I was like, you can watch this. You won't even see a monster. and yeah, she's watching it like, this is not scary. This is just bad.
Yeah, it doesn't really work. Yeah, and like we said throughout this conversation, a number of movies have done this better. I thought it's very funny that you thought The Happening was better than this. But
I think I feel strongly in saying that and feel confident in saying that. And the only thing, the last kind of thing to talk about Bird Box, I think, is that the soundtrack was written by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, but like, yeah. I don't even recall the soundtrack.
Me neither. Yeah. When I was prepping the Patreon episode, I looked up on YouTube to see, you know, what score was present. And that's when I discovered, you know, Trent Reznor, who I love, and Atticus Finch.
Atticus Ross.
Atticus Ross. I'm thinking of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah.
And Atticus. Wait, is that Atticus Finch?
God damn it. I went to public school.
Yeah, I didn't read To Kill a Mockingbird. Okay, what was I saying? Okay, these two musicians who I love contributed to this score in, I mean, I guess a pretty stripped down score because it doesn't call attention to itself at any point and it's not terribly interesting and it certainly doesn't enhance interest in what is on screen. Yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel bad for everybody involved.
Right?
This is one of those movies where you're just like, that's rough. Maybe the next one will be better, man. So, yeah, I don't know. Movies that have done this better. We talked about The Mist.
Yeah.
The Road, whether it's Cormac McCarthy's novel or the movie. The Happening, a little bit in terms of like bits and pieces of, say, like Dawn of the Dead. But most closely, especially recently, it will be compared with our next movie, A Quiet Place. Okay, so directed and co-written by John Krasinski of The Office. John Krasinski, I don't know. I think of as like crowd-pleasing vanilla because he's very likable. He's
he
kind
is.
Of like cross-palette likability. That's got to be worth something. I actually watched all of the Amazon Prime series Jack Ryan.
Jack
is that
Bauer.
The name of it?
I don't watch those kind of shows, so I don't know.
John Krasinski co-wrote this along with Brian Woods and Scott Beck, who did the original treatment, which I think landed with Paramount. And it was kind of like an early incarnation of this. It had some of the dynamics and it was kind of starting the world building. Then John Krasinski, I think, was offered the role and offered the opportunity to direct, and it kind of escalated. And so he continued writing with them and I think chose their story, but like further down the line, focusing more on the family and sort of taking this world as already set.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what happened was I was sent a script 3 weeks after having our second daughter, And so, yes, it's a scary movie, but what was in it is a story about this family trying to survive. What would it, you know, what would you do for your kids? Like, what extremes would you go to protect your kids? And I was such a wide open vessel after having our second daughter that I was just like, oh my God, this is so good. And so now when people say, like, man, the movie's so scary, I'm like, thank you so much. But the best compliment is when people come out and they said, I'd never thought I'd cry in a horror movie. And I'm like, that's it. That's why I did it.
In other post-apocalyptic movies, kind of show you a couple different elements. Sometimes you get to see the apocalypse as it happens. Sometimes it's years past. In this case, it starts us at 472 days after monster invasion.
I yes,
don't know exactly. I mean,
I guess I would say a monster invasion. Who knows? And I like it. I mean, the thing is, though, is like 400 days is really not like that long in the grand scheme of life. So they kind of act, though, like, oh my gosh, this has been 50 years sometimes, some of the things that they get into. And that kind of irritates me a little bit about this movie. I love this movie and I like the feel of it. But when you start picking at it and digging a little bit deeper, it's not like that pretty under the paint.
It's got a couple plot holes.
Big ones.
Okay, so an IMDb synopsis is brief, but in a post-apocalyptic world, a family is forced to live in silence while hiding from monsters with ultra-sensitive hearing.
Fair.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at. So in Bird Box, they can't make eye contact with whatever ethereal being is beyond their senses. And in this case, they cannot make a noise. So they are, it kind of feels like the original writers, Brian Woods and Scott Beck, might have encountered Bird Box as a intellectual property and kind of recognized that, like, well, visually, this isn't going to be great. This isn't a great story to tell with invisible monsters. But what if we transition to a world where audio is king?
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I love to death the premise of a family who, in this case, have a hearing-impaired daughter. So the actress Millicent Simmons plays Emily Blunt and John Krasinski's daughter. She is, in fact, hearing-impaired. And so the premise of this family having a hearing-impaired child that they take it upon themselves to all learn, is it Universal Sign Language?
American Sign Language, ASL.
ASL. So, I mean, I'm fascinated by sign language as it stands, but I love the idea of kind of transferring the venue of dialogue to sign language for a film.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a weird call to the HBO show High Maintenance. I think had an entire episode that was kind of cast, and then like the cast would sort of hand off to different characters, all of which were hearing impaired and speaking through sign language. And it's fascinating. I like seeing it. I think it's really also important to represent in film. And in this case, it turns out to be the saving grace for this family.
Right.
The idea that they can communicate without sound is the reason they survived the fucking apocalypse. And I love that. I thought that was a really clever take on it.
Yeah, ASL is one of those things where I'm so, like, ignorant of it. And occasionally a person will stop, like, on the train and try and ask you something in ASL. And you're like, I can't help you. Like, I can't, if this was in Spanish, if this was in something else, I could probably help you. But ASL is one of those that I'm so ignorant of it. And I wish that I would sit down and actually take the time to, like, learn a little more about it.
It's a quiet film rather than a silent film, and that's a really interesting distinction, I think, because there is a lot of sound, but the characters themselves aren't allowed to make any sound. And it's funny how quickly, I think, it's been really nice to see how quickly the audience becomes very much like the family in the film, where people are eating popcorn, opening up their candy, and then realizing that the family can't make sounds. Then you just watch as, you know, however many hundred people are in the audience just slowly put their popcorn down, like, this is going to get me killed.
In this world, you know, quiet world, the family have outfitted everything from, like, the walkways And they live on a corn farm.
Seems that way. Yes.
Yeah. And it's funny. It does have the sort of recurring theme that you call bullshit of when children are running through cornfields.
And not getting paper cuts like maniacs.
Yeah. I notice in this, it feels like the corn is actually pretty spread out, and maybe it's due to like the time of the season, but like there was a lot of space between different corn stalks. And
I think it was just for this film. Just for filming purposes, they were like, can you please separate this a little bit bigger?
Yeah.
So we can fit our cameras through, we can fit everything through.
Right. I guess there's also that.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it takes a lot to get through there. So I think they were expanded just for the sake of the film. One of the scenes, though, that's so real and scary is the scene in the grain silo where the grain sort of like drags a character down. That really happens. Working in a grain silo and a grain elevator is very dangerous.
I was going to ask you about this because it kind of plays the role of quicksand.
And it does. And then what happens is you can't breathe because then it packs around you and you can't inhale any further. And so you just suffocate. It crushes you.
Have you ever been inside a grain silo?
Not with corn in it. No, because that's very dangerous. You're not supposed to be inside them.
Okay,
but I've been in empty ones, obviously.
Okay. An empty
supply. You play in those. That's fun.
Are you like, I don't know. No, I guess I'm thinking of like water towers in more like suburban areas where the, you know, cool kids would climb up and smoke pot.
Yeah, no, my parents actually have a tiny grain silo by their house and it's empty. Oh. It's not used. They use it for storage. And my mom painted it to look like a crayon. So there's that.
Oh, that's so funny.
That's the crayon house in Illinois. That's my mother.
Yeah, so the movie wound up in a lot of people's best of lists for last year. And after watching it a second time, I'm all for it. I think even despite the plot holes, and we'll talk about those more in depth, I picked up on one or two things that I was skeptical of the first time around. And it certainly did well. It made $340 million worldwide. And considering the budget, I don't know, it seems like the numbers fluctuate, but between $21 and $17 million, like that's a huge return on investment. Again, like being happy for the people involved. Well, I guess John Krasinski more than, say, Michael Bay, who produced the movie with Platinum Dunes. Yeah, I don't know. I think this is one that kind of gets through on its own merit.
You know, the one thing, though, and then we'll go through the film a little bit more in depth as we go on, but one thing that kind of drives me crazy is this film, very successful in a year where there weren't maybe 100 million successful horror films, and no one gave it the It Follows treatment that like It Follows or Babadook got, where it got the backlash when people said it was good. People said, yeah, it is good, instead of saying, well, not really, or have you ever seen horror, or this or that. This is, it didn't get that kind of feeling, and I think it's because of the likability of John Krasinski.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that it is a kind of bare bones story. It's interesting how little actually happens in the movie. And I will say, like, it is a mercifully short hour, and like, it's like an hour and 35 minutes about.
Mm-hmm, compared to Bird Box, 2 hours.
It didn't need to be. But yeah, that A Quiet Place moves through. At its core, it is a family who kind of deal with loss. I think they do. Okay, so let's talk about the monsters, where Bird Box kind of shit the bed and missed an opportunity to do something really interesting with the visuals. Here in A Quiet Place, they do show us the monsters. And I did like 98% of the framing of the monsters. I like how they were treated by the camera. I like that they didn't, there wasn't ever a well-lit hero shot of the monster. We eventually do get a lot more than a glimpse, but by that point, like, whatever, it's all cranking, it's all going fine, just show us. But yeah, I like the treatment of it. I like that they held it back for as long as they could, and then they finally.
Yeah, and it didn't feel like Signs, where when you see the aliens in Signs, you're like, God damn it. This was still very scary, and there's some great basement monster scenes that I just really, really loved. So let's dig into this.
So in relation to Bird Box, you talked about how it serves an allegory for, like, a reluctant Sandra Bullock as a parent. A Quiet Place, it's less of an allegory. It's really up on the screen, but they do go through the sort of melancholy of having lost a child.
Right. Well, that's something, like, when they were asking Krasinski, you know, what kind of influence, what kind of things influenced you? And three films he mentions Alien, obviously, No Country for Old Men, which is just, yeah, that makes sense as far as, like, the feel of the film.
Yeah.
But one of my most favorite films that I never want to watch again because it just... my heart's not ready for that, is 2001's In the Bedroom is a film he cites, and I'm always mentioning that when I think of, like, just a great film from start to finish is In the Bedroom, and it's also about the loss of a child, but in their case, and In the Bedroom, it's an adult child, and it's, oh, like, really, really good. I recommend everyone watch it once, but probably you don't need to watch it again unless you're feeling really down.
Who are the stars in that? I feel like I...
That's Sissy Spacek and Tom Wilkinson.
Ah, okay. Now, I haven't seen the movie, but I do remember when it was going around.
You know, it is about the loss of a child and how two parents cope. Obviously, in A Quiet Place, they cope very differently than in the bedroom. But it's still kind of interesting to say, like, oh, John Krasinski said that really did influence me.
Having lost a child, and it's almost like the, well, no, it is the, like, prologue to the movie, and it is our very quick introduction, and it's a great shorthand. I think the film, because it has to think almost exclusively visually, they do get through a tremendous amount of exposition without ever saying a word.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a scavenging family who are traveling together. They're very concerned about making noise. They have a child who is hearing impaired and a youngest boy. And we get all that in a short period of time. And I like that the alien is so quick in the first moments that, like, you're not even afforded this visual. Yeah, I really liked the build-up intro. I thought they got through a lot of material. And it's also beautiful. It's like upstate New York in the fall. Like, it is gorgeous.
I would have moved probably to somewhere warmer in the end of the world. I'm going to a warmer place.
I wonder if it was supposed to be somewhere else. If, like, it was filmed in upstate New York, but I wonder with the grain silo, like, are there corn farms?
Not too many, and because New England farming, New England, like, terrain is not always ideal for that. So it could have been, like, they were thinking, like, Pennsylvania.
That would make sense.
Or, yeah, there's, like, fields for days there.
Pretty early on, I did like the gadget basement that John Krasinski was running with, like, all the TV monitors. I don't remember seeing a power source. Do you?
No, but obviously, I mean, because they also have this very clear light system that they're using, so
yeah,
they must have a generator or something, but where are they getting all this fuel? But again, it's only been like 400 and some days. It's not like years and years in the future.
Yeah.
You know, but yes, I'm kind of confused on where the power is coming from. There's a few things that make me a little bit confused, and that's okay, and I'm willing to overlook them. Especially after Bird Box, I can overlook a lot of things.
Yeah, no, the height of technology in Bird Box is wearing blindfolds over your face. And even some of the blankets they use are the, like, Afghan holy style that, like, have a lot of gaps.
Yes. That seems like cheating.
It really did.
Because she's, like, looking and seeing shadows. And to me, I'm thinking, like, monster is going to get in through that little, you know, what is that, like a 50 thread count thing on your face.
Yeah. So going back to the gadget basement, John Krasinski is working on a cochlear implant. It becomes more apparent later, but at first it looks like hearing aid. But then you do see that she does have the cochlear implant. So, like, it's established technology, and you figure just in the process of, like, running away and fleeing for safety, and over the course of a year and a half, like, she lost her original cochlear implant, so he's having to manufacture one out of, like, speaker parts and soldering things together. And so this one doesn't work.
And it seems like he's tried this many times before.
Yeah.
And that's what's so sad.
That heartbreak in her, where she's just, like, encouraging him to give up.
Mm-hmm.
What she does find out is that, I guess, if turned high, it... So this took a little sort of construing on my part, but it becomes ultra-receptive to what seems to be, like, the highest band of the audio spectrum. And that has something to do with how the aliens echolocate. So they are seemingly generating a sound that we might not hear with our natural ear, but her cochlear implant hearing aid picks up on it and, like, kicks it back and gets stuck in a feedback loop.
Right.
That's complicated, what I just said. Like, that's a lot to take in. I was glad to have watched it a second time because it made it way more clear.
I was just like, I took it at surface and I said, oh, she turns it up and it hurts them. The end. You don't have to go into all of it.
It's not all that different. Did you ever see Tim Burton's Mars Attacks?
Yes.
When they play the high-pitched yodeling-style music, like old Grand Ole Opry Country kind of.
Right.
And that makes the aliens' heads explode. Like, this is that level simple.
Yes. That's pretty much where I put that. And I had, I don't know if you remember, in the old days, I don't know if you had, my great-grandfather had lost his hearing, and they gave him one of the big giant hearing aids.
Yeah.
Well, what would happen with him is he would have it turned up so loudly it would just whistle this really high-pitched whistle that he could not hear, and everyone else had to be like, either we pretend like we don't hear it or we'll be like, Elmer, please turn that down. And he, of course, then it would go into this, like, what? And we would just, everyone would just be yelling. And in the background is this high-pitched, whistly sound. So I can understand the aliens, like, frustration with the whole thing.
That's hilarious. So I don't know where the trend began, but I don't know if you tracked it on Twitter. When the Bird Box Challenge started going around and morons were putting on...
I only saw one, and it was a little kid running straight into a wall that, like, was literally holding their parent's hand running straight into the wall, and I thought, that kid will never trust anyone.
Now, this relates to a mini spoiler in the movie, but it really does bother me that someone steps on a nail, and it seemed like it was very avoidable.
Yes.
And I kind of treated it like a too manufactured plot device. But I thought it was kind of frustrating. At the same time, I saw the Bird Box Challenge and thought, like, hey, let's try and get a Quiet Place Challenge. Let's have people step on nails and not make any noise at all.
Yes, that nail situation is one of those where you just get enraged at your children for being like, that's like, it's like a Lego, leaving a Lego on the stairs. Except for tetanus is involved.
Yeah, no, I guess that is one of my pet peeves. I guess I never really gave it that much thought, but in any movie, when a character does step on a nail, It irks me out. Although that's probably everybody, though. Like, everybody... Is it just a New York thing?
Yeah, no one wants... It feels bad to stand on a nail.
Well, of
I'm
course.
Sure.
But is it something that, like, you legit worry about? Because I kind of do. Like, I look at the floor when I walk, generally.
Well, I'm worried about stepping in, like, dog shit when I walk.
Yeah.
But not nails.
I think it's... I don't know what made me think of it, but we talked about it in our New York Horror episode. And during our conversation about Chud, we talked about the moment Daniel Stern in the subway is like eavesdropping the Chud dance party that's happening further down the tunnel. And he kicks some rocks accidentally off like his perch. And we called bullshit. We're like, no New Yorker would be so thoughtless about the ground in the subway. Like, that is just covered in feces and awfulness, and you'd watch exactly where you put your feet down. And so, yeah, I feel like that is kind of walking around in New York. You're just kind of constantly looking for obstacles And
absolutely.
It's often poop.
I think the best stepping on a nail situation is in your next, when she has the trickster nails.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then the bad guy thinks, haha, I've avoided your nails. And then there's the nails he didn't see. That's one of the best traps she makes. So much like Bird Box, there is a labor scene that I call also bullshit on. Bullshit. Now, Emily Blunt might be a lot of things. She's very beautiful and a great actor. Apparently, she sings too. She can do all the things, but I'm calling bullshit on being super quiet and delivering a baby.
Well, right. It's like the audio equivalent of lifting a car to save your baby, right? It's that like you've overcome this impossible feat, which would be delivering a baby quietly, because you had to, in her case. No?
Right. I mean, I guess, number one, she goes into labor very quickly, but it is her like fourth kid.
Right.
So yeah. Maybe that makes it easier and she knows what to expect. Maybe, but I'm calling major BS.
Yeah, there's a bathtub scene that's super intense. And I'll also tell you, this is how good she is. She does one take of that scene. That's it. One, that's all we need. And we were all so shocked. The crew was like this, like holding the microphones and stuff. And then I call cut, and this is how professional my wife is. She goes, does anybody know what they have for lunch? Like right after the most intense scene ever. It's like, cut.
Woo! She is phenomenal.
Is it like chicken or fajitas?
Oh, okay. Fajitas.
I mean, there were very strong details that lent to like her character development. She was checking her blood pressure on a daily basis. She knew like how many
really
weeks
good.
For her due date. Like she was on top of it, considering the world had ended. Like as responsible as irresponsible parents could be, that's kind of where they are, because that's the other kind of obvious plot hole, kind of call into question people's judgment, is why continue making children in this terrifying post-apocalyptic world?
Also, like, how boring was that sex with the super quietness?
Yeah, no, they got to do it in the padded basement too, I guess. Yeah, no, that's nuts. Although I thought it would be really funny if, like, there were deleted scenes that showed, like, yeah, they're like a really devout Catholic family. They like old school, like Vatican I sermons in Latin, no birth control. He refuses to pull out. Like they really.
Gross.
I did like the tension in the movie. I guess I wasn't really thinking. I thought her performance was fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's great in this. I think everyone's pretty great in this.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of calling a little BS on that. That's all. That's all. Just a little.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like if movies really showed like what deliveries were like I don't know that it lends itself to like a cinematic treatment.
No,
of.
It's I think far less dramatic. This was one thing also in Bird Box where we're watching it, and Emily Blunt doesn't do it in this one, but Jackie Weaver, when everyone starts wanting to give birth in Bird Box, Jackie Weaver's like, get some buckets of water. What the shit are you doing with all these buckets of water? Why are they always getting buckets of water?
I remember from movies from the like late 80s, early 90s, it was get us newspapers and boil some water. And I would always watch that and go like, are you making paper mache puppets? Why do you need those two things? What is that?
What are these things doing?
Yeah, I don't know. I think newspaper, if it's brand new, is it presumed to be sterile? Like in a pinch if you don't have towels?
No, because the ink comes off on everything.
That's hilarious. Your newborn baby is just covered in schmutz. They've got letters and words just stamped against their head.
They look like a chimney sweep.
So, yeah, so this time around, when the creatures do come into the house, and that was something that I did pick up from the trivia page, but I noticed watching, we never see any doors close. The closest we get to it is the basement space that has the mattress that goes over it. But mm-hmm. I kind of figured, yes, I get it as far as squeaky doors and wanting to avoid that. But, like, wouldn't it give you some amount of protection in terms of, like, soundproofing potential?
Yes, you would think that. But it seems like, well, this was also part of it. Certain noises did not bother them, and certain noises did, of equal volume sometimes.
Yeah, it seemed pretty selective in terms of what was triggering and what wasn't.
Like a rustle of leaves would sometimes get somebody, but some whispering wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, they all, it's funny. I guess the sort of compromise with the American Sign Language was that they were speaking quietly. Mm-hmm. As they went through it. I think that was for the audience. But
yeah, but I'm just saying, you know, they're very pixie choosy with what kind of the aliens are hearing or not. And then I wondered, how do you know when if the aliens, like, how far can they hear?
Yeah, that you part's know? Not really clear. You get the impression, like, if there were three in that general area.
So just don't live by those guys.
Or the other, like, kind of plot hole that people have talked about pretty extensively is the idea, like, why don't you just live by the waterfall? It seems like it would solve a lot of problems.
It seems like it would solve all the problems.
Yeah, although building any sort of home is probably out of the question. So even if you did want to live by the waterfall, you would need shelter.
Yeah, that's true.
And that, yeah, it would just be eternal camping. And okay, now I get it. But in terms of the doors, like, wouldn't you just grease the shit out of a door like WD-40 until it's dripping, sopping wet, and let that?
And what if you built a fountain?
Yeah. Yeah.
They have electricity. They could get a motor and build a fountain, a loud fountain.
Yeah, and it wouldn't even need to be on all the time. I mean, the same way they triggered the lights, they could. Okay, we're solving their problems for them. We've moved into that mode.
That's the only thing that bothered me about this movie. I love the feel of this movie. I love the acting. I love the premise of it and everything. But there were so many things where I was like, just go live over there. Just build a fountain. Okay.
I was thinking about the baby box, and they had planned ahead, and I guess maybe she was some kind of, like, medical professional, because they even have the, like, baby-sized oxygen mask.
Right.
And I was like, that's incredibly specific. Like, they must have searched far and wide for that.
Because I thought to myself, you can't put a baby in a little tiny box and expect good for you and your breathing, right? It's like a Schrodinger's baby. So in this family, in where we kind of find everyone in the story, there are two children, and it's actually very sad and touching, the relationship that they have with each of the parents and with each other. But in my thinking, I don't know, I feel like I was a very quiet kid, but I think to be a kid in this kind of universe would be the worst thing ever.
Yeah, and not for nothing, like, I'm sure they're sweet kids, but your older sister being your only friend when you're like a 7-year-old boy, like, that doesn't sound awesome to me.
No.
Like, and I mean, neither for her, because there's a little bit of tension between, like, her and the dad, and she kind of, you know, kids kind of blame themselves for that kind of thing. And in the situation where she's responsible, feels responsible.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she kind of is responsible, let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that, like, kids don't really have great foresight. And yeah, I mean, she is, but you can't really blame a kid for something like
that. No, you can't blame her, but, I mean, let's, you know, be honest there.
You know what? Not for nothing, but the dad, John Krasinski, should have held on to the batteries, because you probably need batteries around the house.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We've also solved that part of the movie.
we're movie problem solvers.
We're armed with hindsight. That's our special skill.
We specialize in Monday morning quarterbacking. I don't think I'd have a problem being the quiet kid. I think I was generally, especially younger, I was good, like, just give me some drawing paper and I'll see you in a couple hours. Like, I was fine to, like, be left alone and trust that I would be quiet. I think I kind of prided myself on being sneaky and, like, trying to hide around corners and eavesdrop on people and stuff like that. I thought I was a little spy.
Which, that makes sense to me, because I remember your dad telling a story of you getting your head stuck in a railing one time.
that's the opposite.
You were trying
of being
to
sneaky.
Sneak through there. Oh. And then got a little stuck.
That's hilarious. Yeah, my some ninja, I got my head stuck in a pair of bars.
kind of my favorite story that your dad tells. Because I can imagine that they just tried to like put butter on your head and just slide you back through. But I know.
Do you remember how the story ends? Because I don't think I got the courtesy of butter or oil or anything. I think they just pulled me.
No, it ends with your dad like kind of like popping you on the head and pushing you back through.
He mushed my face.
That's how the story ends, is your dad kind of like bops you on the head and that's how you get out.
I don't remember that. That's so funny.
Yeah. So there's that. It's better than like a high tension ending to getting stuck in a railing.
Yes. I should be grateful my father didn't run a bureau across my head and snap it off at the neck. That's
a
deep cut,
Mindy.
Your
sister didn't.
That's a deep
cut. You're lucky your sister didn't. She was so mean to you. I was one of these kids who, and I still am like this, I can like keep my shit together really well in a bad situation and up to a certain point. So when I broke my collarbone because I had been to see the circus, which was bad on my parents' part, and I thought I was a trapeze artist. So I was on my swing set and then did a little, I think I thought I was probably going to do a flip, but all I did was land on my head.
Oh my
and
God.
My neck.
Out of that, you broke your collarbone?
Collarbone.
Was your head smashed to the side into
your
collarbone?
I don't know, Darren. I was a little kid.
Well, but it sounds like you might have, like your head and your face might have pushed down so hard that you broke your own collarbone with your face.
That could
Do you
be.
Hear what I'm saying? Like, you can see me doing it on the camera. And
yes, I can
like,
see it. I'm not quite sure. The listeners can't see it. But we could probably take a screenshot of that so that everyone could see that you really thought about this in a forensics kind of way. I don't know. The point is I broke my collarbone. My mom is watching from the window, sees like, oh, shit. Well, okay, she didn't die. So that probably helped my mother because it landed right on my noggin. So I quietly, very quietly, pick myself up, walk to the door, very composed. And mom's like, oh, maybe she didn't hurt herself. As soon as I open the door, just like, blah, screaming. And then we had to go to the hospital.
Wow.
But I'm very good at keeping my cool. So this was a film that was really, really loved by critics. It had a 95 on Rotten Tomatoes, which I always have to check. Like, do you want a lot of numbers or a little? You want a lot, so that's good. So it's like, hey, that's amazing. Then it won the American Film Institute Top 10 Film of the Year. It won a Critics' Choice Movie Award for Sci-Fi Horror Film. It won the National Board of Review Top 10 Films for the Year. Again, I mean, it was a pretty big kind of film for horror. It was a great film.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the early, like, first preview trailer and getting really excited, but more so, like, it wasn't about, I don't know, an alien movie so much as the way they used audio and built tension, even in those early trailers. And it's kind of a feat in terms of, like, low-budget filmmaking, where it's such a stripped-down and effective family story, and it still manages to like incorporate alien monsters, and that gets pulled off. I dug so much about this. I really, especially on the second viewing.
And talking about sound, just even the sound and the tension that is kind of brought up in it, it was nominated for a BAFTA for Best Sound. And also the score is the score by Marco Beltrami, who we would know from, he scored like actual instrumental scores for Scream, Mimic, The Faculty, Resident Evil. I mean, he's the guy. But he's also been nominated for films like 310 to Yuma and Hurt Locker. So he's not just a horror guy. And this is the guy that they had doing the scoring of this film. And it creates this, sometimes we expect certain things from horror soundtracks and certain things from, what do I want to say, like other dramas, legit, I guess, film acting and stuff like that. We expect a certain soundtrack for those kind of films. And I think this gave this legitimacy to a horror film by having someone who's done both kind of scoring.
Yeah. The attention to detail in terms of sound, they also use it to demonstrate the hearing impaired daughter, her world. And I thought those were great moments. I really enjoyed the like stripping away of all audio and then taking on her perspective. And for as much as sign language has served this family in terms of survival skills, it is absolutely terrifying to think of the daughter's perspective and living in a world where sound is going to like trigger your almost certain demise.
But and you can't tell when it's happening.
Yeah. I compared it to being in shark-infested waters, but not being able to look below the surface where you're treading water. Like, that's just pure anxiety, that your whole life is kind of nervous.
Well, and I think, too, you sometimes see these videos of little tiny, like, toddlers and things getting cochlear implants and hearing for the first time.
Yeah.
And it's darling. And then to think, like, that's taken away from you.
Right, yeah.
That's a whole other thing. It was something that was given to you, and she probably had an experience like that. And then suddenly to be taken away again in the worst situation possible, the worst universe and environment ever. It's something I heard, and this could have been so kind of cool, but I'm glad it didn't go that way, is that this story could have existed in the Cloverfield universe, and they were considering that, yeah. And I mean, I love the Cloverfield universe, but I'm glad this didn't go there.
Do you think it would have been different?
Well, then I would have been like, well, why do these guys rely on hearing and these guys don't in New York, you know?
Yeah.
I guess, would have been annoyed by the inconsistency of it.
And it wouldn't have made sense. The impression I got from 10 Cloverfield Lane was that there was a broad spectrum of alien types. So I could see these guys being like the, you know, Northeast Coast branch of alien invaders.
The quiet ones.
Yeah, no, I think it works best on its own. I also don't need every Cloverfield movie to necessarily be like alien-centered.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't think it would have changed the way I feel about the movie if there was a little bit of like news footage that gave you context for the starting point. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have strong feelings about it, but it is interesting the way these projects kind of get shuffled around, and it's just like Paramount is looking at their properties and they're like, Cloverfield? Maybe Cloverfield Lane?
This is very successful. And, you know, I mean, I even like Cloverfield Paradox. I didn't hate that.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately. I kind of am tempted to go back and watch it again, but I don't know if that's a terrible idea.
You might want to leave it where it is.
Yeah, maybe I'll watch something I haven't already seen twice.
Aww.
I think that's as good a place as any to wrap up this episode. That was the year start. Happy 2019, everybody.
Yes. Happy New Year.
Yeah. Starting out this new year, how about sharing a review with us? If you go to iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play Music or Spotify.
Yep. Don't forget, we're on Spotify now.
Yeah, still exciting. Still got that new car smell, our Spotify page. Yeah, we're on all social media as well, so drop us a line at Rants Macabre on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. And am I forgetting anything?
Yes.
Yes.
You can also find exclusive feed on our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/rantsmacabre. This month, what did we just talk about? Literally talked about it yesterday, and now my mind is gone.
Purple Rain.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We had a rant sequitur about Purple Rain. Rant sequitur is something we do where it's movies that everyone in the United States has watched, and yet somehow we haven't watched them.
Yeah.
I've watched Purple Rain because I'm not a psychopath, but Darren hadn't until just recently.
Okay. I think this was all started because you had never seen A Star War. none of them.
That's
so
true.
You did that. I did St. Elmo's Fire, right?
Yeah, you
that
did.
That was my movie.
Which is so good, right? You can still say that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy those movies, the, you know, like Big Chill style, or it was more like a prequel to the Big Chill.
Right.
Yeah, no, we were thinking in terms of ones that you haven't seen, Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I mean, I'm not eager to revisit Titanic to talk about Titanic.
Yeah, it's and one also, of those I just haven't seen.
Yeah, I don't know that. Well, we'll think of something good. We're going to go through the AFI's top 100 movies of all time and figure out the sort of ubiquitous movies you haven't seen.
Exactly, because there's quite a few on that list that I probably haven't seen.
Yeah, so that's
just don't
over...
give me Lawrence of Arabia, okay?
No, no one has that kind of time. Ain't nobody got time for that.
that would be like me making you watch Gone with the Wind. It's not worth it.
But I feel like Gone with the Wind...
The juice is not worth the squeeze.
I'm not eager to... Okay, perfect. So yeah, so that's on our Patreon page where there's a whole separate library of horror-related content. And as you've heard, Rant Sequitur episodes where we talk about anything but... and most recently we did Purple Rain. I haven't ever seen it. And it's particularly shameful because I'm a Prince fan.
Yeah.
But now I'm that much closer to being a Prince completist. Yeah. So I guess that's good. I'm exhausted. Let's end this here. Happy New Year, everybody. Looking forward to our continued work watching horror movies and talking horror in 2019. So that'll do it for me. This is Darren signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light, split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one did disturb the sound of silence. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words like silent raindrops fell, echoing the wind of silence. People bowed and prayed to a neon god they made. And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, the tenement halls, whispering. Silence.
Rant Macabre. Cutting.
Cultured.
And curated.